Commissioner. Let's go pre-break session, discussion. I think such a philosophy to have, perhaps we will have time for one or two more formal presentations from somebody. So first speaker is Sergio from YPP.
I can show you. I should thank the organizers for letting me speak first and for letting me speak in this session. As many of you may notice, it's called time reversal symmetry breaking. I will mention time reversal symmetry breaking, but that's not quite the main point of this talk. The main point is something else. This talk will attempt to address a question that has been of the center of lots of debate in this field. And the issue really is, how can we nail down the question of whether or not the electron is fractionalized in these materials? We've heard at least a couple of talks on fractionalization. The thing that's that I'll be relying on quite a bit is the one by Matthew Fisher. We also heard Nagarwasa talk about the possibility of fractionalization. So the question in some form at least is whether, particularly in this part of the phase diagram, the so-called underdose regime, at low enough temperatures, whether it's correct to think of the electron as having fractionalized into perhaps two independent excitations in such a way that the charge is carried away by a boson and the statistics and the spin is carried away by something else. And this is a sharp theoretical question as you go down to zero temperature. So what we'd really like to know is what the precise experimental characterization of such a fractionalized phase is. So what I'm going to do is to describe a physical effect that's a robust and precise experiment that gives a precise experimental characterization of such a fractionalized phase. I'll first just describe the effect, and then I'll go on to give you a quick explanation for why it is very generically expected to happen. So let's imagine performing the following actions. We start with an underdoped sample of one of the cube plates in the normal state, the so-called normal state, in a cylindrical sample or a ring or something which has a hole in it, in a magnetic field, and I want to imagine that it's normal, so that it's that you start off at a temperature above TC, but I don't want to imagine that it's at a temperature that's very, very high. In particular, I want to imagine that you're starting off at a temperature that's low enough that the fractionalization has had time to set in. So we imagine the sample in a field, and then we imagine cooling it down into the tube connecting phase. And as hinted by lots of experiments, one might imagine that this superconducting phase is ultimately adiabatically connected to a BCS superconductor. Now, in such a case, and certainly in any superconductor, once the state becomes superconducting, it will expel the field, the magnetic field, from the interior. And if you arrange things, you can certainly arrange things in such a way that some amount of flux is trapped in the hole of the cylinder. And in particular, you can arrange it so that exactly one fundamental flux quantum, namely Hc over 2e, is trapped inside. So this is a pretty standard effect, and some things have been observed in ordinary superconductors for more than 40 years now. So this is the starting point for the experiment. The next step is to heat the sample back to the normal state, just above TC. But again, we would imagine that we only heat it to temperatures which are much smaller than the temperature at which fractionalization sets in. So once the sample becomes normal, the magnetic field is no longer expelled from its interior and it will start penetrating into the sample. That's again a very general effect. So now we imagine turning off the magnetic field so that the sample becomes normal again. And finally, we imagine cooling the sample back to the superconducting state, so that we cool it back to T less than TC. So this is all that we imagine doing. And this is simple enough that I hope that everybody's understood what we want to do. And you might think that this is a fairly mundane thing and that nothing remarkable is going to happen. But I claim that if the normal state is indeed fractionalized, then all sorts of extremely strange, remarkable things happen, which means that you can use precisely this experiment to nail down the issue of whether or not the electron breaks apart in that part of the phase diagram. The first effect, the most remarkable effect basically, that if the normal state is fractionalized, then you generate a spontaneous HCO2E flux at the end of the experiment when you cool it back into the superconductor. And it's spontaneous, so that the direction of the final flux is completely uncorrelated with the direction of the magnetic field that you initially applied to the sample. So it's completely uncorrelated with the initial flux. So the final state has broken the time reversal symmetry that you achieved when you got back to the normal state and turned off the magnetic field. So this is the only connection with time reversal breaking. But this is a definite physical effect that would exist if the normal state is fractionalized.
Yeah. Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
When does this happen?
This happens if the normal state is fractionalized.
But as you cool it down, when does it occur?
Oh, okay. So that depends on... I'll get to that. I'll get that at the end of the talk, certainly. There are all kinds of other robust predictions that one can make for this experiment. Another remarkable thing is that there should be an even odd effect. The initial flux is exactly n times HCO2E, which you can certainly arrange it to be by changing the initial magnetic field, with n being some integer. Then you'd see a spontaneous final flux at the end of the experiment, only if n is odd. And if n is even, you wouldn't see any spontaneous flux. And furthermore, if n is odd, the spontaneous flux that you see would be HCO2E, but again, the direction would be completely uncorrelated with that of the initial flux. And yet another effect is that you see the spontaneous flux at all, only if the axis of the cylinder is along the C-axis. If you imagine doing the experiment with the axis pointing the AB plane, there'd be no final flux at the end of the experiment. So all of these are sharp, robust statements. And much of the robustness of these effects arises because fractionalization is in some sense a topological, a fractionalized space has something topological associated with it, as some of you may know. And this effect should persist independent of things like how dirty your sample is and whether or not you have stripes in that part of the phase diagram, and all sorts of other real-life complications. As a theorist, a more ideal experiment, which is of course much more challenging and perhaps impossible, is not to kill the superconductor, not to move out of the superconductor by heating and cooling, but rather to imagine sitting at an extremely low temperature and move back and forth between the superconductor and the normal state by tuning some other parameter. If one could do that, that would be the ideal experiment. Of course, we don't live in an ideal world, so I imagine the best way to do this experiment is by heating and cooling.
You can do it by photon dopings.
Perhaps. So one could imagine doing it that way, but I don't know.
It's been done in IPC.
Yeah. It's been done, and the other thing that's been done is to gate that is a thin film of ITC by putting it on a ferroelectric substrate and so on. So, well, it's conceivable that one may be able to do it the other way, but the simpler thing to do first is just heat and cool. So why do these happen? Well, let me very quickly give you the reason why this happens. So the main reason is that apart from the fractional excitations into which the electron decays in the fractionalized phase, it also has some other very weird excitations, which you may remember from Matthew Fisher's talk. And these are these topological excitations. They're basically vortices which are said that two of them are amount to having no vortex at all. So they're what we call Z2 vortices. And for lack of a better name, we decided to call them bisons. They're vortices which have some icing-like character to them. You may think that these are extremely exotic and strange, but these in fact are extremely crucial for the explanation of superconductivity based on these fractionalization ideas. Now the reason is that the simple explanation for superconductivity within this fractionalization scheme is to imagine that the electron has broken up in such a way that the charge is carried away by a boson, so that the charge has now been liberated from the Fermi statistics of the electron. So then one imagines that this resulting charged boson condenses, and that gives you the superconductor. And now the claim is that this superconducting state is actually in the same phase as a superconductor that would be obtained by condensing a Cooper pair of electrons. Though it's been obtained through a route that's completely different from condensing a Cooper pair of electrons. Now the reason that this remarkable statement happens to be true is that, the reason why it's surprising is that you're condensing a charged E boson, and nevertheless one is claiming it's a conventional superconductor with a HC over 2E flux quantization and so on. And in particular, the reason you can manage to get the HC over 2E flux quantization is precisely because of the existence of those topological Z2 vortex excitations. So the existence of those excitations, which we know theoretically is crucial for this phenomenon to happen, also enables one to explain the occurrence of a conventional superconductor. In fact, it's necessary to explain the occurrence of a conventional superconductor through this route. So in this view of the conventional BCS superconductor obtained in this unconventional route, the ordinary HC over 2E vortex, the ordinary HC over 2E BCS vortex, is to be thought of as this topological excitation, a Weisshorn, that's bound to a HC over 2E unit of electromagnetic flux. So this is really at the heart of the explanation of all those strange results that I mentioned earlier for the experiment. Let me quickly go through how that works. So let's start in the superconducting phase with the HC over 2E flux trap. And let's move to the normal state, perhaps by heating or perhaps by tuning some other parameters and so on and so forth. Clearly the magnetic field will no longer be, the magnetic field will start penetrating into the sample. And because it's normal, it's not superconducting anymore. But on the other hand, if it's fractionalized, then the Weisshorn, the Z2 vortex that was bound to the HC over 2 unit of electromagnetic flux, can no longer penetrate into the sample. That's still trapped. And when you turn off the magnetic field, of course, magnetic field goes away, but this Weisshorn stays trapped. So what one has done through this entire process is to prepare the normal state in a situation, in a cylindrical geometry, but you prepare it in a situation in which it has this Z2 vortex, this Weisshorn, trapped in its hole.
When does the magnetic field form?
When does the magnetic field form?
At the very bottom of the slide, there's a red circulating line.
I'm still out here, let me get here. Oh,
sorry, what?
No, I'm still out here, let me get to the stage. And then you're asking about this?
Yeah, wait.
Yeah. Yeah, so the question now is, how do we detect the existence of the trapped Weisshorn inside the hole in the cylinder? And the simple way to do it is just move back into the superconducting state. Because once we move back into the superconductor, this trapped Weisshorn cannot exist by itself. And it has to nucleate a HC over 2E unit of electromagnetic flux. And the result is a trapped HC over 2E vortex, a conventional BCS vortex that's not trapped inside the hole. So that's the effect. So what was your question?
When does it occur?
When does it turn on? When you cool into the superconducting state, at TC, yeah.
Why does the Weisshorn state track if you turn off the B field, but then later on you need the B field being attached to the Weisshorn?
Right, so inside the superconducting state, the Weisshorn cannot exist by itself, basically because it imposes anti-periodic boundary conditions for these charged E excitation that are condensing. But outside the superconducting state, the Weisshorn is not attached to any electromagnetic flux. It just exists by itself. It's an excitation, it's a gapped excitation of any fractionalized phase that we can describe into two or higher dimensions.
It does exist in the normal state.
Yeah, absolutely, and its existence is absolutely crucial both for the fractionalization and for the explanation of the occurrence of superconductivity.
Yeah, is the normal state generating any magnetic field?
No. So you're breaking time reversal spontaneously.
I don't understand. Does the normal state break time reversal?
No.
But the superconductor does.
No, the superconductor, if you reach the superconductor by starting at the normal state where you have a Weisshorn trapped in the hole, then the resulting superconducting state, you'll generate spontaneous currents which are such that you produce a spontaneous flux in the hole.
How big is that flux?
But the flux is
Sorry, what?
The flux is random.
Exactly. The direction of this flux has nothing to do with the direction of the initial flux.
This is a plane of theory, right? I mean, you really have a stack of planes.
Yeah, absolutely.
So How do these bisons connect from plane to plane?
Okay, I'll just come to that next transparency.
In your step one, isn't that transition that needed to be a possibly solid transition of double vortices?
All I'm assuming at this stage is that the normal state is fractionalized. I don't really care about the university class of the transition.
But if you have a quick normal state of proliferation of vortices, you can't be proliferating have single vortices because then.
Yeah, if you're doing it at zero temperature, that's correct, and that'll be related to the ideas that Balanson Company had for reaching a fractionalized insulator by starting from the superconductor.
The normal state, this is very standard versus single.
Right. Exactly. So this is a pi flux, right? So this doesn't have any physical currents going around it. So this state doesn't break time reversal symmetry. Yeah.
So he assumes that flux is always trapped in the superconducting state. When you come close and you see it, presumably you can tunnel very easily and carry away a line.
Yeah, okay. It's a question of, you have to worry about doing it. Certainly you could raise the same objection even for just taking a normal metal in a magnetic field and cooling it through TC, right? And we do know that you can get to trap enough magnetic flux that way. Yeah. Yeah.
Why do you need a torus?
Oh, it's a cylinder.
Yeah, I know.
We need to trap these. Sorry. So we need to trap these fluxes in the holes of the cylinder or the torus. We are probing a topological property of normal state, and so it's good to take a multiply connected geometry.
It's only one layer thick.
Sorry?
It's only one layer thick so far.
So far I've not assumed anything about how many layers thick it is. And so let me get to that in the next transparency. And I should finish up. That's the last two transparencies. Okay, so the Steven Ward effect is quite easy to understand. The initial flux is NHCO2E. You have a trapped bison only if N is odd, simply because two bisons are equivalent to no bisons. They have only a Z2 existence. And so that immediately explains the even odd effect, because if N is 2, for instance, and you have HCOE flux that's trapped initially, then you heat the sample to the normal state, there is no trapped bison. You cool it back, nothing happens. Now, regarding this multi-layer question that various people have been asking, there are various kinds of fractionalized spaces that are possible in theory. But the one that's most likely relevant to the qubit is one in which the packings of the electron are confined along the c-axis but are deconfined in the AB plane. Now in such a fractionalized space, there are loops of these bisons. There's some Z2 flux, and there are loops of these Z2 flux that are condensed between the various copper oxide layers. And because these loops are condensed between the various layers, if you have a cylinder whose axis is oriented in the AB plane, then a trapped bison can very easily escape because, it'll be absorbed by the bison loop condensate that exists between the layers, and so you lose the bison and you won't get the effect. Okay, so let me just make a couple of comments. One is a practical matter, an important practical matter, and the other is a question about,
There is or there isn't an effect in the 3D system?
Sorry?
If you have a 3D stack of systems,
right.
You have the effect?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
You have the effect in the cylinder axis is along the C-axis, but not if it's in the AB plane. So at finite temperature, just like in the quantum Hall effect and so on, you have to worry about how robust this topological order and the effect is. And at finite temperature, the trapped bison can certainly escape, but the time that it takes to escape would be exponentially small in one over the temperature. And the scale that's setting that exponential decay time is the gap for the bison, which if these fractionalization ideas are correct at all, the lower bound for that bison gap would be at least T star. So in terms of materials in which to do this experiment, the best bet is to do it in a material where we can maximize this ratio between T star and TC. And one suggestion is perhaps to do it in this code 2212. Now the other comment is that, as far as I can see, unless you have this kind of 2D fractionalization, two-dimensional fractionalization as opposed to the 1D type related things, or if you don't have any, unless you have this, you're not going to get all of these effects. And in particular, if you don't have any fractionalization at all, you certainly wouldn't get all of these effects, presumably.
So you probably can answer some other questions during the question. So what?
And
I want to ask about this the fact that we have 2D flares. And,
right.
Because this flux may not be able to find its way back out through the hole. Because this bison is trapped presumably on one specific one of the layers. Is that correct?
No, it's trapped in all the layers, actually. I mean, in the superconducting state, you have a vortex that's going through each layer. Now, once the system loses its superconductivity, there is a bison that's trapped in each of the different layers, but there is no communication between the bisons that are trapped in the different layers, simply because there are bison loops that are condensed between the layers.
Okay, so it's trapped in every layer.
Right.
The charge D boson, as far as I understood, the HC over 2E vortex of the charge D boson combined with the bison to become a stable object.
Right.
Okay, so then under the Kauser-Douglas transition, where you have the disassociation of HC over 2E vortex, why couldn't those vortex carry the bison and move into the hole?
So the assumption is that the fractionalization sits in at some temperature which is large, like T star, and that the superconductivity sits in at this lower temperature, which is TC. And then if you're doing experiments of well at temperatures above TC, but well below T star, then the bisons would, I mean, the tunneling of these bisons would be suppressed by this exponential factor.
But I think the cost of charge transition would be HC over E, or is
that right?
Absolutely.
The prediction
is.
And yes, and what
you're talking about what you did.
Well, no, I mean, what Dunga is making is really the point of what I made, that if this is really correct, then the cost of solid transition must be one of HC over E vortices.
The zero temperature transition, certainly, but the finite temperature transition.
You have to see the effect. If there are HC over 2E vortices proliferating in the finite temperature transition, the effect will disappear.
Well, it could be very, very, very rare, right?
Yes, so the finite temperature transition would, okay, it would be the 2D XY, maybe. Okay.
Right, but there is a.
Yeah, I think it would be HC over 2E, but
yeah. If you're in the normal state, low T star, so your bisons are gapped and your electrons are fractionalized.
Right.
What is the difference between having one gap bison and having no gap bison? So basically, what happens if your bison escapes from the cylinder?
Oh.
Is there anything that changes that one can measure without magnetic fields? Or what changes in state of the matter?
Oh, once the bison has escaped, is that what you're asking?
Exactly, if it's gapped.
But once it's already escaped,
mm-hmm.
Then it's pretty much like a sample where there was no bison.
I think this is optimal on this
but
could you just sketch on the board total energy versus number of fluxes trapped in the
Oh boy. Okay, what do you want to know? The
total, just a sketch of the total energy
versus
the number of superconducting flux quanta trapped in the hole.
In the beginning or at the end of the experiment?
At the end, after you blow up the thermodynamic state at zero temperature.
Oh, the thermodynamic state at zero temperature would certainly be a state in which there are no vortices trapped. Right? But
you said
if you,
that's not true. You said
No. But if you do have a vortex trapped for some reason, it will take an extremely long time to tunnel out of the superconductor.
You didn't understand.
It's a metastable state.
Exactly. It's like cooling the superconductor in a cooling normal. Take a piece of lead, cool it in a cylindrical sample of lead, cool it in a magnetic field, and turn off the magnetic field.
Let me ask you a good question now, and maybe take the premise of the experiment.
Right.
You set up the vacuum, set up the insulating, the parent vacuum with this extra degenerate vacuum. Okay. And now you're going to cool it down, and thermodynamically, it's going to decide to go into to have one or minus one, but not zero. It doesn't like to have zero.
Right.
It doesn't like to have an even number.
Right.
Now,
in an infinite sample, the ground state would be one in which you have either plus one or minus one HC over 2E vortex.
Okay.
That. Now, that's in thermodynamic.
Okay, so what does this mean? That means as a function of N, it goes up, down, up, down, up, down.
As a function of the initial N?
Yeah. So it's a function of the number of vortices of flux quantum trap.
It's a metastable state at the end. You would still prefer to get that HC over 2E flux out. But it would take an infinitely long time to do so.
Yeah, so in an infinite sample, it would that HC over 2E flux would never get out. But in a finite sample, I mean, the outer diameter of the cylinder is finite, so it would escape. But, yeah. That's just like in any...
Now, if you're at zero temperature and you're in this, and you guys are in the superconducting state, isn't it just exactly why we get with an ordinary superconducting state?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, an ordinary superconducting, a piece of lead in which you've cooled in the magnetic field and turned
exactly
off the field.
What you know from ordinary superconducting.
Right.
Know your book.
No, the experiment, Walter.
Yeah, I'm still worried about this, the fact that it's layered, and if there's no communication between these bisons from one layer to the other, then when you cool it down, how do you know you might not get some sort of plus minus and end up with no flux outside?
I mean, the flux that's going through a single layer, I mean...
But then, well, you're assuming...
It has to go somewhere, basically.
And then tends to nucleate the next layer?
Exactly, absolutely. I mean, it costs too much energy for this flux to, once you've gone superconducting, for the flux to start and penetrate one layer, go all the way out, and for another flux of the opposite sign to come in.
Yeah, I was just going to address Bob's question. There is a case under which you do get this oscillation, so you're not losing the energy, and that's if you just take a vortex in a bulk singly connected superconductor. Then in their situation, the energy, core energy of a vortex would oscillate from even in all vortices. But not in a multiply connected joint.
Last question.
Is it necessary that charge be bosonic?
I mean, certainly, if you're going to explain the superconductivity as arising from fractionalization, it is necessary that the charge goes on. At least the conventional superconductor, which I mean, all the experiments seem to tell us that it is.
But what's going to determine the sign of the electromagnetic flux that eventually is
cut? It's spontaneous symmetry breaking. Right? So if you have some small external field, that will determine.
No spontaneous symmetry breaking mechanisms that at least I know of. Normally, what you need is some boundary conditioning.
Okay, the Earth's magnetic field is going to determine that. The Earth's magnetic field will determine that.
It's remarkable that people are only running for amendments when there's no question. Next speaker is Masajir, and
okay, I'll briefly introduce some work that's been done last year, mainly with Matthias Voiter, who's over here. Can you hear me? He also has a poster on the effect of zinc and nickel impurities on the resonance mode, and also the SDM experiment of Seamus Davis, and I encourage you to go look at it afterwards. All right, my house is luckily on the other coast, so I will begin by just mentioning photo emission. We'll hear about this tomorrow, I imagine, in great detail. So there have been a number of observations, in particular by Vala et al., who have looked at the lifetime, or the energy width, more precisely, of the nodal quasi-particles. And the main feature I want to take away from this transparency is that these nodal quasi-particles seem to be rather broad, even below TC. So I want to emphasize, I'm talking about the nodal quasi-particles and not these hotspots that many other people have discussed. All right, so I'm not going to present a theory of everything, perhaps nothing, but here's the question I'm going to answer. So I want to ask the following question. Is it possible for a D-wave superconductor to have nodal quasi-particles whose spectral functions of energy widths have ordered KT for temperatures much below the critical temperature? So this is a simple well-posed question I'm going to address. and try to answer it in an unbiased way. And the focus will be, now, in generically, in fact, you'll find you can't do this all the way down to zero temperature. You need some fine-tuning. So the guiding principle of the discussion will be under which, for which systems you need minimal fine-tuning. Okay. And of course, if I just take an ordinary PCS D-wave superconductor, these spectral widths from any reasonable interactions will be about a T cubed, and look for something larger than that over a finite temperature range. Okay, the basic framework I'm going to use is something that many people have discussed today, is to assume that as a function of some parameter S, and S need not be doping, although perhaps it is doping, but for now let's just imagine this is some parameter that the theorist has available to tune, that in the D-wave superconducting state there's nearby some critical point to another state X, and I'm going to sit down and write all the possibilities for the state X, and then think about the nature of this critical point. Now, if you have a critical point with the right properties, then what will be the case that if I come down in temperature here along this line, then under appropriate conditions, you'll indeed find, because of certain scaling arguments, that the nodal quasi-particles have an energy width of order kT down to t equals zero. Now, of course, the physical system surely is not sitting at the critical point. And the scenario I'm going to propose is that perhaps, at least in optimal doping, you're somewhere here, so that in this intermediate temperature range, you do see spectral widths of order kT, but eventually, as you go below this crossover line, you go to an ordinary D-wave superconductor with well-defined quasi-particles, which can have, in principle, very long lifetimes. So the question I'm going to ask is, can you list all the possibilities for the critical point which have this property that the line width of the nodal quasi-particles here is about a kT? And surprisingly, this simple question has only a limited set of answers. Yeah.
I don't understand the two states in between which you are having a transition.
I haven't told you what the other state is. I'm just going to not make any assumptions what it is. I'm just going to ask what state X can give me.
X.
Yeah, that's the mystery. What state X can give me a width of order kT? You might think that any old critical point will do it. In fact, the main point of my main message is that, in fact, not any old critical point. There's important restrictions that come from the consistency of theory. Only a few candidates work. All right. What does that do with reality? I don't know, but that's the question I'm going to address. So first of all, to get the basic idea behind quantum critical crossovers is that you have a critical point with strong interactions, even at short distances, at right at the critical point itself. A more technical way of saying that is that the quantum critical point is interacting field theory, which is below its upper dimension and has an important hyperscaling property. And it's really this hyperscaling property that leads immediately to energy widths of order kT right at the critical point. Furthermore, this, you know, of course, we can imagine some order parameter which obeys property one, but it could just be the nodal quasi-particles are not connected in any way to that. Now, clearly, we don't want that. We want the nodal quasi-particles to be part of the critical theory. And I guess this is something related to that. And furthermore, the critical field theory shouldn't be a trivial theory. It should be interacting. So these are the three constraints I'm going to put. And what we'll find is that just these simple constraints lead to only a restricted set of possibilities. So, since I only have 15 minutes, so the framework of the theory is the following. We start with the D-wave superconductor with the four nodal points. I write down a familiar long wavelength theory for the excess fermionic station in the vicinity of these nodal points, and ask what can lead to scattering and a critical point which involves these degrees of freedom. Now, the fine-tuning condition leads to an important conclusion, which may or may not be valid in the real life. But if you pick a certain order parameter, one simple order parameter you could think about, which perhaps certainly exists in some materials, it's some density wave order parameter. It could be a spin density wave corresponding to the onset of magnetic order, or some kind of charge density wave corresponding to some stripe state, being the state X. Now, if this density wave order parameter has some wave vector G, then when you have phi fluctuations coming by, they're going to scatter the nodal quasi-particle by the same wave vector G. And now, generically, this point they scatter to would not be the other any other nodal point. And under such conditions, basically you violate one of the conditions I wanted to satisfy, which is number two, that the nodal quasi-particle in that case are not really part of the critical theory. You can, they're virtual fluctuations, you can integrate them out, and you're just left with an ordinary theory of just a usual classical type order parameter. All right. So if I don't, I guess. So what's clear then is that I need, for these kind of simple order parameters, I need a special condition, an additional fine-tuning condition, if you wish, that this wave vector g must connect two nodal points. So if this was exactly equal to this distance, then in fact this theory would satisfy all the conditions and everything would be happy. So if you're happy with that, then, or say perhaps a spin density wave transition near pi pi, which is scattered from here to there, and it could indeed be that the real system, that's all we need. But let's imagine for now anyway, for the sake of argument, that we are seeing in many different experiments much stronger scattering at intermediate temperatures, and ask, you know, what other order parameters could possibly give you damping which is linear in T. Now the staggered flux state was considered by Chetan earlier today, and this has basically the same problem. You need, first of all, fine tuning of G to be exactly pi. The nodal points have to be exactly at pi over 2, pi over 2. And furthermore, even if you had that, the fermions in fact have a gradient coupling, and as Jason himself mentioned, this doesn't lead to any broadening of the spectral functions even at the critical point.
Excuse me.
Yes.
This is a false dichotomy.
Okay, fine. Ignore that last comment and then we just go on with the, can I? Sorry, okay, go ahead.
No, I don't want to talk about it right now.
Okay.
I want to call you on it. This is a false dichotomy. It's over-constrained and not really criticism. Go ahead.
All right, okay, I think you will agree that this particular critical point within the d-density wave and the d-wave superconductor does not have fermion spectral functions of order kT even at the critical point. That's the statement. All right, so once you accept that here, the order parameter is zero momentum, and furthermore, it's unlikely to be spin triplet, so let's just, for simplicity, assume spin singlet, you can take more complicated fermion order parameters, which are not bilinear, but they again, in fact, don't couple in a relevant manner to the fermion degrees, to the nodal quasi-particle degrees of freedom. So through some fairly simple but somewhat technical arguments, you end up with the conclusion that the only order parameters we can think about must be fermion bilinears at zero momentum. Okay, so now you can pull out your group theory and list really all of them. It turned out to be only 7 possibilities. And the order parameters can be simply characterized zero momentum order parameters in terms of a pairing function beyond the d-wave pairing function, or possibilities of excitonic order. And here are the 7. So many, almost all of which have been considered before by other people. You could have an additional component which is IS or IDXY, and both of these break time reversal and have also lift the gap near the nodal points. You could have a more exotic IG pairing. This is L equals 4. This doesn't lift the gap, but it turns out not really to couple to the nodal degrees of freedom anyway, so we won't have to worry about this. Finally, there's a number of other interesting ones which, again, don't lift the gap, but break lattice symmetry. You could have an ordering where the nodal points move away from the diagonal direction to, say, the x or the y direction, or they get compressed this way and that way. There's sort of a shear deformation. And both of these could be thought of as some kind of superconducting nematic states, which pick out a given direction, but otherwise don't break any spatial symmetry. Or you could have a D+D pairing, where the nodal points move clockwise or anticlockwise, and something more exotic with P. So the basic, you can list all of these and try to write down a theory for the critical point. There's some order parameter which turns out to be a simple Ising order parameter in almost all of the cases except for one. And you have to couple this Ising order parameter to the nodal fermions. And the cases only differ in the nature of these Nambu matrices that appear here. So now the thing you have to do to work out the theory of the critical point is do an RG analysis for this coupling lambda. And what you need to get fermion spectral functions of width kT is that coupling lambda has to approach a fixed point of which is finite at the critical theory. And once lambda approaches lambda star, you'll have the right type of scaling. Or you could find that you simply get runaway flow, which suggests some kind of first order transition. So the basic result is, after you do this analysis, only two cases, the first two in fact, have a fixed point, have a nice second order transition which involves nodal fermion. All others seem to, you have no fixed point whatsoever and most likely have some kind of first order jump, but not a continuous transition. So, and both of these cases break time reversal, really these are the unique cases in which you could have an order parameter at zero momentum, which is a continuous phase transition involving the nodal excitations. So that's the main conclusion out of this analysis, and whether this has anything to do with the real world is still open for debate. I just want to propose some speculations, which you can fill me on. So what I'm going to argue is that there are some indications from the experiments, particular photo emission, that we're somewhere here, and to have this state in here, this state X is a D+ ID state with DXY fluctuations. And when you're in the quantum critical region, the fluctuations of the T broken state come in and damp the quasiparticle strongly. But eventually, at some temperature, this damping disappears and you get well-defined quasiparticles. Now, so the speculation is that there's some indication from Ong's experiments that this is what's happening. Let's see. So the state X with D plus ID order has a non-zero kappa XY even in zero field because it breaks both parity and time reversal. And in a sense, it's a unique state near a Dirac superconductor that has this property. So if you imagine, in a sense, kappa XY divided by the field is really infinite here. So if you come down right at the critical point, you expect kappa XY to diverge as you hit this critical, right down to zero. But if you come down here, it'll go up and eventually go into normal D wave superconducting behavior. And if I take the liberty of showing his data, on kappa XY, there is a huge increase down to a temperature of order 28K, below which you see Simon Lee scaling and perhaps just conventional D wave superconducting behavior. So the proposal would be that this crossover line here is roughly around 28K. Below that, you have ordinary D-wave superconductivity, and above, you have fluctuations of chiral order. And one consequence of that, so the testable, is that photo emission should also see something happening at that same temperature. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. I should emphasize you. Okay. Yes.
In trying to interpret the kappa XY data, there is a prefected T in front of it. That's why there's this maximum. So it's better to actually consider kappa XY divided by T. I'm given carrying entropy, so this includes a prefected T.
I thought you were just plotting kappa not XY.
Right, yeah. Kappa XY itself carries entropy T.
Okay, that's
so,
alright.
So this apparent maximum has nothing to do with breakdown of Simon Lee scaling or anything.
Alright, well, but 28K was the temperature on which you stopped seeing the scaling. Okay, that's what I'm basing that estimate on.
But it's a bit odd to say that this data supports your old edifice of critical point, when in fact our data shows that gamma is not proportional to kT.
Gamma?
Yeah, the scattering rate, which was the beginning point of the whole.
Well, I mean, what I would say is that up here you have a strongly coupled theory of with the chiral fluctuations, which we haven't worked out. And below this crossover temperature, you can use simple D-wave quasi-particle like ideas, but at these higher temperatures, I would say you can't. And we don't have a theory for that. This is what we're working on.
Yeah.
go back to the Green's function that you wrote down.
Yes.
How big an eta can you get out of this? This was a big.
Oh, let's see. All right, we only have estimates from epsilon expansion.
And how much can it
be? Again, Matthias would know. I don't know.
But it's about all the epsilon expansion calculation for 2 plus 1 dimension gives you very small eta.
Well, let's see. I mean, the only etas we know are just pure bosonic field theory.
Right.
This is a theory we know very little about. We don't know.
People have calculated etas for fermion field
theory. Numerically?
Yeah, current.
And if eta has to be, if I understand it right,
yes,
for the emission data, eta has to be substantially big.
It depends which state are you talking about. I mean if you take the optimal doping data, it fits reasonably with fairly small eta. But if you've got lower doping, the things are more one-dimensional, you're right. You need much larger values of eta.
Any isolated quantum critical form, which has an effective theory that looks like a relativistic field theory, right?
Yeah.
These ones are the ones I think
that take on these problems.
They all lead naturally to
rather
small.
That's what I thought too.
Yeah. All right. Okay.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. So did I understand it correctly that these are long wavelength fluctuations, so they shouldn't affect the electrical current or electrical transport? So the transport lifetime would not be big.
That's right. I mean, yeah, that's correct. We haven't figured out what the effect of impurities and we haven't done any calculation on transport yet, but that's correct. They don't, in the simplest theory, they don't affect the electrical current.
Should you be able to couple directly to these chiral fluctuations? I don't know, with an optical experiment or something?
You could imagine, yeah, Raman would see something at the same frequency then. Yeah. Yeah.
In with some particular
right. That's right. Well, okay. Right.
Your question was about the Raman field. Can you talk about the critical point effect of the magnetic field?
Well, yeah, in a magnetic field, the critical point would disappear. It would just be a crossover. There wouldn't be a sharp singularity.
So people say if I'm sitting to one day is slightly larger than that, where I'm going to give it an internal field.
Yeah.
Well, if it's so like, cause is, okay, you always get into the people that I need or.
Well, I mean, once you have a magnetic field, it's a tautology that you have D plus ID order. You've broken all the symmetries you need to get that order. So I don't know what. Okay. I don't agree with that. Okay.
So just on the level of the effect, what happens in the critical point in the external field?
It disappears. There is no critical point. Yeah.
What happens is the fluctuation requires the mass.
Well, to the lowest order, the mass of fluctuation is independent of the magnetic field. This is the other point we were discussing.
Why did these critical fluctuations affect heat transport more than anything else? Shouldn't, if they're there, shouldn't they show there all transport?
Well, I mean, I'm talking about kappa XY. They're certainly very special.
Why?
Because these are the fluctuating the big PNT. So they're, you're going to a state where kappa xy is infinity. Kappa xy over b is infinity. I mean, the kappa xy is non-zero even in zero field. That's one thing that's special. Yeah.
If your ordered state is a finite q and you miss the nodal point,
yes,
multiple q, are those irrelevant?
That's right. That doesn't work.
What figure, official figure of recession in the green?
Can you hear me with that microphone?
Oh, sorry.
Oh,
Yeah, come on.
A lot of you say a lot of support. Some of it will be repeat, not that much of it. We're going to talk in the beginning about the plate of hypercritical tunneling. Before, I'll show some disco data that's indicative of broken time reversal symmetry. And then thanks to everybody who worked with us. A lot of people have been doing this for almost 4 years now. As you recall, when you tunnel into the AB plane of YBCO and disco, you typically see the zero bias conductance peak. And when you tunnel in the C-axis, you don't. The bottom line, I will not discuss any C-axis tunneling because the only thing I'm really certain of is that I do not understand. One thing I'm very certain of, I do not understand the spot of curve. And maybe we can talk about that with other people later. The entire talk of the tunneling will only be on the AB plane tunneling, and VSR also will be on that. And for those of you who have seen this stuff before, to remind you, because Sasha asked me to mention a couple of theoretical issues, although you don't need them in this room, for the bulk U-wave superconductor, you expect to be something like this, and we measure this. And that is a result of the formation of the surface-induced end-wave bound states, which is an intrinsic property of an unconventional superconductor at certain interfaces. And there's been work going on this. The first people have calculated the existence of these states go back to P-wave superfluidity in 1982. In the Brandon's group. So, in a nutshell, without any equations at all, this is the cartoon. This whole thing is calculated using the Eilenberger approach. I can't do that, but I can understand line by line using the Andreev approach. If you scatter something here, there's some quasi particle that scatters across a symmetry breaking surface of one of these materials will go, if you follow its trajectory, it goes to the order parameter this electron experiences changes sign. That means it feels a very strong Andreev reflection. That there's a whole series of things to calculate. It's known how to do this in the early 60s, and the bottom line is you get a peak of zero bias. That also goes even earlier to other theorems, et cetera, the Tye-Singer index theorem, because I'm talking theorists, so I thought I'd mention that. But what happens is that the zero bias conductance peak is filled up from two things. One is there's pair breaking, and the other one is some of these quasi-particles and the coherence peaks also do that. Now, we've been measuring the zero bias conductance peak since the middle to late 80s. And I also have measured many, many other zero bias conductance peaks. And I want to bring this up. Just because you see a zero bias conductance peak doesn't mean it's one of these Andreev bound states. I discovered some of these things myself. There's many, many, many things that produce zero bias conductance peaks. And there's diagnostics you need to prove this. Okay? Here are some. This is my experimentalist monkey view graph. We do all of this. Okay, we check it out. Magnetic field dependence. I don't have time to tell you all the diagnostics, but crystallographic dependence, field dependence, direction of field, etc. And I'll mention some of those things here very quickly.
How about the phase of the moon?
The phase of the moon is really important because you have to have the materials. and it's still a little bit of a black art and gray with YBCO. One of the things that we've known for many, many years is that when you apply a magnetic field to this zero bias conductance peak, it splits in a certain fashion. And it splits according to a Doppler shift. Okay? This field scale and many things fit this Doppler shift of the quasi-particles in this Andreev bound state. It does not fit the magnetic scattering scenarios because we're about two orders of magnitude off of the field scale. And that's just to show you here that I actually showed this, but these are data from various junctions. That's the low field Doppler shift, VF.PS. PS is the superfluid, and VF is the electrons at the Fermi circles. If it was magnetic scattering, the splitting would look like it would be much, much lower. I have to bring up one more thing in tunneling before I talk about broken time reversal symmetry, and that is that what we've seen, and it's also shown by Krupke and Deutscher, is that the quasi-particles involved in Andreev bound states, forget the details of this, I'll be happy to discuss it, they only move along the AB planes. Okay? So not only do you have the quasi-particles that are confined to the surface on the order of the coherence length of 3, they also do not travel in the C-axis direction, almost like one-dimensional current. I can't say that, but they're highly anisotropic. okay? The quasi particles move along the AB planes. Now, the origin of this, and this is why the tunneling I think is so controversial, is because there is one model-dependent pointing here, and that is this Doppler shift, which I think is right. But the origin of this splitting is the fact that if we measure the splitting indicates there's a field present. So if you see it splitting in zero applied magnetic field, that means a spontaneous field has appeared. And that's the definition of Bruckheimer universal symmetry. And since we made our measurement a bunch of years ago, other people have measured it, and it's controversial because it's really hard to measure. You need to prepare the surface and make junctions with non-superconducting conduit electrodes and et cetera, et cetera. It's difficult. It's been repeated, but it's hard. And another important thing, which I want to kind of go into, we might come up in the discussion, the kind of disorder and the degree of the disorder is important. We measure differences between nanofaceting, which means disorder, shiny surfaces on the order of 10 or coherence length scale, versus atomic disorder. And I hope that comes up in the discussion. One of the effects is the Visco tunneling. This is very interesting. In the YBCO surfaces, which anyone who's ever been to my talk in the last 4 years knows about this, the surfaces of our YBCO films are specular and nanofaceted. So as a result, we're tunneling into many different orientations at once in the AB plane. Hervé Aubin gets single crystals of Visco from David Hinks, cuts them and sands them in different crystallographic orientations, and he doesn't have nanofaceted surface. He has this atomic disordered surface. As a result, when he goes below this tau-breaking transition, which is 6 or 8 degrees, depending on the sample, he sees a depression in the center, but this doesn't look exactly like the tau-breaking does, the T-breaking does in the YBCO. What we see in the YBCO splitting, with that splitting that we saw, we don't just see a depression of the density of states at zero energy. What we see is that Hollandre bond state broaden as you lower the temperature, if you do the correct thermal analysis. Okay? So we see a real splitting. In this case, I believe it's time reversal symmetry breaking, but it's a belief because we don't see a broadening. But we do see one thing that's sort of interesting, and I don't think I've shown this yet, but we're learning for guys like Yazdani and David to make pretty pictures in tunneling. As we go down in temperature here, we see this splitting come in here. And if you look at these two modes at the side here, here's the splitting come in. And we also see at comparable temperatures to T-breaking that we see in YBCO that some of the modes actually move out, the tunneling dips and valleys, whatever they're due to. That's just sort of interesting, if anybody wants to talk about that later. This is all I can say about the state, okay? That is that. I could go into, I don't think I will. How much time do I have?
7 minutes.
I'm not going to discuss many theoretical issues because the whole thing that motivated this was a phase diagram put down by Fogelson, Ryan, and Saul. However, looking at these data very carefully, all I can say is that I've gone into the phase transition into this new state, and therefore we've broken the symmetry, there's a new order parameter. I don't know what it is. Okay, D plus IS, D plus I, and I think it's this, right? I can tell you why I think it's this, but I don't have proof yet. So it's one of these, and we're just going to have to figure out what it is. That's one of the things we're studying. Because this is somewhat model dependent, because this has been somewhat controversial, we're doing a lot of other experiments, and our most successful one, successful because it's one, probably because we have messages we got working on it, but is this ESR experiment. So what we do is we look at a bunch of things, and we're looking at electron spin resonance, and I'll tell you how we do this. We look at an ESR line, and we look at the broadening, the shift, and the skew, the first moment, second moment, and third moment. What we do is we spin on a spin probe. We go by this thing, BDPA. And it has a line width that's intrinsically 0.75 Gauss wide. And Benson Pugel worked very, very hard to make these grains small enough and put it close enough to the surface without disturbing it chemically to maintain that 0.75 Gauss line width and get it on the order of 400 nanometers to 400 to 500 angstroms within the surface. Okay. So now we have a very nice probe, and this is the bottom line, and then I'll show you the analysis of the data. I have a poster on this, and I've got more data up there. But basically, if you, this is the derivative of the line width, okay? Because you take the data in derivative form. And this is what you see when you go from 15 to 4 degrees, whether you do it field cool to zero field cool, okay? And this is what you see, the top one is what you see for C-axis YBCO, in which case you don't expect it to keep breaking. We don't see it in the tunneling. PBCO, which is not superconducting, or stress and tightening, okay? You don't see any change. But we do see a change when we look at 110 or 103, the AB plane oriented YBCOs, okay? And what we see is some change here. And it's hard to see what the change is, but we can quantify it. And we have direct calculations of the broadening, the shift, and the skew. So what we can say then is that as we lower the temperature, these are the ones that the purple and the blue filled in ones where we expect the T break, and those are the AB plane surfaces that we're measuring. And we see at around 6 degrees, we see the line shape broaden. These are direct measurements calculating and integrating the line shape, the derivative of the line shape. Okay? And then the CX is YBCO, the non-superconducting samples, there's no change of temperature. That's a measurement of T breaking. The next thing is, since we wanted to get more information out of this, is that if we worry about the direction of the applied field, we find something that totally agrees with the tunneling. That is that if we have, okay, you're not going to follow H parallel, it's perpendicular. Basically, we find that the moments are pointing along the plus and minus C direction. Now, we can't tell if it's plus C or minus C, so that's arbitrary, but on either, you know, C top and C bottom. And it's about 80-20 that we measure reproducibly. Finally, there's another measurement here, which we're still trying to figure out what it means. But we also, absolutely, this is what we were presenting earlier, but we see one of the line shape changes, you see besides the broadening, which is the first moment, the shift, which is the second moment, we also see the skewness, which is the third moment. And we don't really know exactly what it means, but we've come up to by talking with guys like Mike Weissman and Tony Leggett and Charlie Slichter, is that it probably has something to do with the domain structure. We can't figure out any other way to get a skewness to meet this resonant condition and the skewness unless there's some sort of domain structure in this. And I'll be happy to sit down on a piece of paper the rest of the week and discuss this with you. So the bottom line is that we have this. Okay, we see T breaking by the ESR. The shift tells us that it's pointing along the plus or minus C direction. The magnitude is about 3 gauss. That's how big the shift corresponds to. And we compare with the tunneling, which tells us the currents are only along the AB planes, and that if we do the tunneling measurements, the spontaneous splitting corresponds to about 1 kilogauss. And we look at this, we realize it's falling off. You know, you can fit anything you want, but if you consider a bunch of dipoles, a single dipole falls off one over there, R cube, but if you've got a domain structure, it's going to fall off faster. So fitting 2 points, we can get approximately 1/5. Okay, it's 2 points, but it falls off fast. And so that's, besides the skewness, that's another support that there's a domain structure. A model we've come up with is that everything is consistent with coherent length, size, I wrote the words down, let me see here. Near surface nanometer scale current loops that circulate in the AB plane. In other words, if that's the C-axis direction here, and these are the AB planes, then we have these little current loops that are in the AB plane that are going like this way and this way, some kind of, some are pointing that way, that's over this way, some are pointing that way. And the third moment is supportive that we get plus and minus C, but there isn't really domain structure. That's it.
Yeah, when you go below your TS temperature, you see the splitting, and you interpret this as broken time versus symmetry, so you have a second order parameter. Do you have an idea of over which length scale this order parameter decays, and how far, with respect to that length scale, you actually tunnel into the sample?
Yeah, well, standard tunneling goes off pretty much, you know, exponentially with the coherence length approximately, okay? So we're on the order of tens of nanometers of tunneling. How far am I really, that's how far I can measure. Now, the theoretical predictions, you can refocus and write and solve, and other people have done calculations and agree with them or not. I mean, I can only tell you what I measure. And whether it's a bulk effect or a surface effect, I don't really know from my tunneling. I don't measure the bulk, right? I can't get in there. So it's consistent with that theory, but that doesn't mean that's the right explanation. Oh, I'm sorry, something.
If you
have
the
mains,
as you would suggest here,
yeah,
then you should recover a 0 by a p. We should recover a 0 by... At the point where the mains turn into, so you have b plus a s and b minus a s.
Yeah.
And at that point, you should recover, so you get a splitting because you get b plus a s.
Right.
Okay, but if you have a domain wall,
you know, I look at the big thing, but that's something that I agree, and I'm always quoting you on this, I should tell you. Yeah, I think, you know, people ask me all the time, I didn't bring a big picture of our splitting one, but this is our data here, and we always have this little blip in the center, and I gave a talk in Urbana, and this is years ago, and Eduardo said, I bet that's between domains. And I always quote you on that. I think you're right. Okay, so let's write paper. So, okay. No.
Why is it sharp?
Because it's a bound state. This again is the Andrea bound state back again. It's the same argument. It's essentially it's like a solid term, and you go from plus to minus and you get the nuclear state back here.
The question was about the
sharp. Yeah. Because it's a stable state.
So, is the magnitude of the induced ardor parameter near 6 to 10 Kelvin or something?
Yeah, well, we typically measure about 6 degrees in the ESR, and I think that's a big... You should see the way we're taking these data in the medical school. And so what we think it's 6 degrees. I mean, we could be a degree off on that. I know that drives you completely crazy.
Doesn't that mean that the low temperature heat capacity data would be dramatically exponential?
I don't know. This is still a certain effect, probably. So I think that the amount of, you know, centers that are participating in this is going to be real small. That's really why it's so hard to find. Let me also say that this phase transition temperature that we measure really does change with different kinds of surface roughness. It's really interesting.
John, Laura, can you comment on the fossil dope independence of this heat splitting?
Yeah. That's a great question. I have a whole stack of digraphs here, but I'm not going to pull them out. If you dope like crazy with praseodymium, zinc, nickel, or iron-induced disorder, you can actually destroy the zero bias conductance peak, which is real interesting, and it's still superconducting. However, what we find is that if you start doping a little bit at the lightly doped scale, we actually see this transition come in a little bit higher. So we don't have a huge amount of data, but the data that we're seeing, especially with iron-induced disorder, we can actually see it come in a little bit higher. So consistent with other things, like when there's a couple times when we actually don't see the splitting, and we only don't see the splitting when we think we have almost no disorder of the interface. So we think we need to nucleate extra quasi-particles to have enough quasi-particles to actually get into a second, because I think it's superconducting as a second order parameter. But that's, everything's consistent with that.
There is a Neil Harlan's comment about this, but I think the reason why this experiment is so undergoes such scrutiny was one of the questions is because it's probably one of the first ones where you have one of the best basic candidates in the Tamar Rosa violation state. And they all apparently have the data which will be closer to what we can do.
Okay, well, Laura's beautiful experiments have shown, I think, strong evidence for the time reversal symmetry breaking. What I want to do is introduce another experiment where we're looking specifically for whether or not those effects come from a complex order parameter. So I guess in the list here, I'm going to try to add confusion to issue 2 up here. When you go to a state with, this is a map here of different order parameters and the magnitude and phase of the function of k-space direction. And you go from the D-wave state, The order parameter changes sign, so it goes from a phase of pi to zero abruptly at the node direction. When you go to a complex order parameter state with a component of either S-wave or DXY, the main effect that happens to the phase is that this switch becomes continuous. So there's actually states, different angles at which the phase can be anything between zero and pi. So it's possible to pick that up with a phase-sensitive experiment where you want to look in the direction along the node direction where this phase is continuous. So what we've done is an experiment very much like a modification of the corner junction or corner squid experiment. And to do that, we've used grain boundary junctions. And in particular, we've used junctions in this particular configuration. This is a so-called 45-degree asymmetric configuration, where one side of the order of the junction has the lobe of the order parameter facing the junction, and the other side has the node. Now, if this were a completely flat interface, you would expect no critical current at all, because you'd be tunneling directionally into the node of this. But it is, as well, it's been verified by a lot of work, particularly by Jochen Manhart and collaborators, this interface in the grain boundary is faceted. So the order parameter faces into the plus and minus direction. I have 5 minutes. All right, I'll go fast. So the point here is that if the junction is faceted, the directional tunneling takes you in a different direction than the order parameter, and that causes the phase to be varying across the junction. Now, if you have a D-wave order parameter, you get what looks like a complicated corner squid experiment, switches between plus and minus. You get a complicated critical current versus field dependence that looks like this. The point to make here is the critical current is highest somewhere other than zero field, and this pattern is completely symmetric with respect to polarity. Now, what we've done is study what happens if you add a complex order parameter to this, and what happens in that case is two things. First of all, the critical current at zero field increases dramatically. That's because you've essentially gapped the node by adding this other order parameter. And more interestingly, the pattern becomes asymmetric with respect to polarity, which you can see here in the red curve, and that's a direct indication of the broken time reversal symmetry. So we think this is a very sensitive way to test whether or not you have the formation of a complex order parameter. This is a very dramatic effect, even for only a 10% component of S-wave, or actually DXY in this case. So we made measurements on grain boundary junctions as a function of temperature, and the basic conclusion that we find is that there is no effect here. Here is a pure YBCO sample measured at different temperatures. You can see the patterns remain symmetric over the entire temperature range, and every particular wiggle here is reproduced at every temperature. So we would say this junction is D-wave at the highest temperature, continues down to the lowest temperature we measured. We've also looked at this in nickel doped junctions with the idea of looking for this induced phase that Sasha and other people have talked about involving magnetic impurities inducing a DXY component. And what we find is the same result. Here is over a wide range. We've actually gone all the way up to TC on these. From TC all the way down to, in this case, 110 millikelvin, the patterns remain exactly the same and remain symmetric over the entire range, indicating to us that there is no, at least in these samples, any complex order parameter component. So the conclusion that I have here is that in the measurements that we've made, we seem to see dx squared minus y squared at all temperatures. And I think there are three possible ways to consider what may be happening here. The first thing we need to worry about is whether or not these junctions have enough barrier reflection to give substantial amounts of zero bias states. These are fairly conducting junctions. One evidence that exists is that there is, in fact, a zero bias conductance peak in these samples. And we've also repeated this in edge junctions where the transmissivity is quite a bit different. We see the same result. Another possibility is you have domaining, D plus IS and D plus ID, that someone mentioned. This, in fact, does give a reduction in this current critical current enhancement at zero, but in fact, it actually makes the modulation asymmetry even larger because you essentially introduce more facets into the junction. So the other possibility, I think, is that in fact there is no macroscopic complex order parameter, meaning an actual chunk of superconductor of larger than a coherence length, which is actually complex. And that would mean that we have to look for the observation that Laura reported here on time reversal symmetry from something that's more microscopic, like what she mentioned, maybe loops of coherence length size. That could come from magnetic moments or perhaps bond currents of some kind. Thank you.
Thank you. Who is the author of the paper
translation by authorizing rather than the duration of spontaneous mobilization wants to also present. So we have to budget according to your questions.
Thank you.
Yeah, just the obvious bumble. This problem is crying out for SDM. And I just a plea for all you SDMers in the audience.
SDMers.
We'd love to see, I would love to see tunneling spectroscopy done on edges.
To look for bond currents or something in the arm.
Look, well, tunneling density of state.
Yes, tunneling your
position. Tunneling density of state.
Laura?
I think the other is important to grain boundary junctions. Lambert Elm has been studying zero bias conducting states. And his grain boundary junctions up to 9 tesla. He doesn't see a Doppler shift. Okay, there's, you know, it's a different kind of disorder. When I mentioned the BISCO single crystals, when we apply up to 9 tesla, we see dramatic magnetic field effects in a directional transition, as I mentioned, but we don't see a clear splitting. So whether you have atomic disorder order and daily information on brain boundaries, which we know in the end, there are different kinds of disorder, or the kind of films that I look at, or the kind of films that Jerome Masur looks at, which are even smoother, we have different kinds of quasi-particle states that form on the surface, and we plan to get together and talk about them.
I have a comment and a question. So a comment is that I don't think that seeing too deep in Laura's experiment means time reversal breaking. In principle, what you have on the boundary is a one-dimensional band. So if it's this, if you have dispersion, it can give rise to two peaks which are shifted from zero energy. So that's a comment. And the question is, if you have D plus IS and D minus IS domains implying a magnetic field, the two peaks should split in four. So do you see that?
Yeah, sort of. Well, kicking an out around 3 to 4 kilojoules. And all we can say is that we need to study that further. We see some hysteresis in there and we see some funny effects, but we've only realized that recently. I agree that it should split into four, but I'm still confused on that. And then the argument that we should talk about later is, why do we get this onset? I mean, I understand the full-blown Bogoliubov calculation versus the quasi-classical. And the full-blown Bogoliubov, you do get a splitting. Okay, but why does this splitting turn on according to reasonable fields of matching the Doppler shift at, you know, 8 degrees? Okay, it's not there. We see an actual broadening of the zero bias conducting state. It's not the resolution of a dip that we don't see at higher temperature. Does the density of states change at 8 degrees in the tunnel?
Okay, I think let's hear us. I just mentioned I have a poster on this if anybody wants to.
Okay. So confused me. I'm not an experimentalist, but I'm showing some data of the group of the Technion. This is Emil Polturov's group. And they did a very simple experiment to see whether any spontaneous magnetic field is created at TC. See, one thing that I guess is difficult to do is to measure magnetization very carefully near TC, and you need the high TC squid to do that. So they actually found that a small field, which is around 10 to the minus 5 Gauss, comes out of a sample of size centimeter square, so it's about 80 flux quantum. Now, this signal has a few features. First of all, it seems not to depend on the bulk. They cut out the bulk, and they got the same signal, and it actually increased a bit when they patterned the sample that way. So this indicates that the field is coming probably from the edges. Another important thing is does not seem to be temperature dependent below TC. Another thing, it does not seem to be dependent on the thickness of the film very much. So all these constraints, what? Well, they only measured it for the centimeter square, that was the only. So the question is, what's going on? They carefully eliminated the effects of external magnetic field and showed that the sign of the effect is reproducible when they heat and cool, indicating perhaps some small ordering field, perhaps from spin. It doesn't go away at TC. But the question is what's going on, and we raised a few, I guess, two main scenarios. There might be many more. One is that there's a time reversal symmetry breaking, and there's an order parameter of D plus ID with a small coefficient for the D, XY. and estimates of how much symmetry breaking is. If you say that it's happening at a coherence like near the edges, as Laura was suggesting, then you'll have alpha around 2%. But there's another possibility, which personally I favor more. It's that there are pi junctions in the system. Now, you don't need many. It's only 8 flux quanta. Each ladder of pi junction in a Josephson array would produce half a flux quantum at the edge. If you get a ladder of Josephson junctions terminating inside the sample, of course, you get a vortex-antivortex, which won't give you a uniform field. So perhaps what's going on are domains that come from the edges, giving you essentially pi junctions that giving you half flux quantum that add up to a ferromagnetic moment. This very naturally explains independence of width, because half a flux quantum is for any width of sample, independence of temperature below TC once you establish the vortex, and it seems to be stronger in granulate films than unpublished data, but recently we saw on the web microscopic measurements of Kertli's group seeing very strong modulations and fields in more granular materials. So it seems like if the system is more disordered, the effect is stronger. Something that actually I would like to know if it also is seen in the tunneling. So this is a possibility, but it raises a very interesting question for theorists. Why so many pi junctions? What's the mechanism? Why high TC materials seem to have them more than other materials?
Can you just give us a frame in there?
What?
I can't remember the phenomenology of this effect or alleged effect. What happens when you take it up to TC and then bring it back down? Is it randomized?
No. Comes back the same size.
Possibly be pi junctions.
Okay, the pi junction will give you a vortex with arbitrary direction.
That's correct. So it will completely randomize every time you take it above TC and below.
Unless there's a collective effect for many pi junctions, which will be with a very small ferromagnetic moment from spins, would be polarized in a particular direction. There has to be some time reversal symmetry breaking ordering field in the system, which you can imagine. There's spins in the problem, there's and those don't go away at TC.
So the pi junctions per se couldn't possibly be causing such an effect. There would have to be something ferromagnetic in the system that survives above TC.
Right. I suggest perhaps spins.
Why is that?
Uncompensated. What? 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 Maybe.
So I think you should listen. If you do particularly close stuff, there's an why it's important. I think, first of all, the value about what's happening in the more fundamental sort of ground state of Cooper, whether there is a general violation space. Secondly, actually, it's remarkable how from many different approaches, actually, this fluctuating general violating component is coming. So, whether in the presence of magnetic field, whether in the presence of spontaneously generated stimuli. I think, actually, regardless of what happened to the Ohm's experiment on thermal conductivity, I think the issue of the what is the nature of the IDC superconductor in the external field still are resolved. I believe that there is a D plus ID component in the field, regardless of the Ohm generator, the superconductor state. And so, what are the probes for this standard violating state? What are the adequate probes? Because as we see, even though experiments might show high indications of the standard violating phenomena occurring, there are alternative explanations and there are alternative experiments and designs. And actually, it should be mentioned briefly that if you have a complex computer order parameter, then there are some electric modes which are there, and not the fewer viewers, for instance, which can be also measurable. They have some magnetic or electronic ones. So, I would welcome any.
Yes. Can I make a moment? This experiment of Laura's is one of many in the field
you can cite over the past 10 or 12 years that indicate appearing, disappearing, reappearing orders, various kinds. And Phil, probably, I gather, is going to talk tomorrow about how dumb worrying about order parameters is. But I don't think so. I think that worrying about order is, if you do it right, a binary question. Something that can, in principle, be addressed cleanly without models. And that's why this class of experiment is important. There are a lot of people who argue that these are epiphenomena. They're just surface effects, and they don't mean thing. But I don't think that's right. I think this problem is filled with effects that come and go because of the sample quality is bad. And that one of the routes to getting to the bottom of things is to identify clean binary dichotomies that can be answered yes or no. So the question of, is there a secondary order parameter on the surface is one of them. Are there stripes is another one. These are, in my view, excellent questions.
Just to keep this going, so we refer to the effect of magnetic field, it's almost like tautology that the magnetic field will produce in the second place, so like equal order. The fact that you have a strong magnetic field is causing just global fringe patterns. And this happens both in the case of vector system and in the Helix system. So talk about the central mesh moment, it's about the distortion of the wave function. The fact that you're applying PD violating field not necessarily implies that you induce PD violating order parameters.
So the work of Wolfley, for example, that they look at structure within a penetration test, you always induce the TM strike performance.
Right. The point here I'd like to so much emphasize actually, in both cases if you apply external magnetic field, you have a net current. But in the case of a Dewey, you have say SDM or some other measurement, you would see non-trivial component appearing. And then in this simplistic model actually, you have the second component being getting linear with magnetic field. So maybe that's what Wolfley is saying. The moment you have a D, actual much large where you have magnetic field, you don't have to have torque or phase transition into D plus ID phase. That's what I'd like to assert actually, maybe somebody can tell us the discussion. You enter from the normal state to superconducting state, and if it's ostensibly normal to D actual much large for transition, then unavoidably it already carries this parasitic XY component. So the question is actually how to see it, but among all other possibilities of the key violating state, actually, you know, why people rob the banks? Because the money is there. We have already a magnetic field applied in the state is actually with the PD violating, so we can't hold the right things. But I think actually one of the best chances to see the diameter of the violating state would be an external field. You were objecting
to this? There's a time reversal symmetry for the Ying state that's certainly been seen, which is the spin class phase, which at least in LSCL extends on out to, well, past optimal doping. In these experiments on DISCO or YBCL, do we know whether the spin class phase is there?
There's some evidence for that.
Great point. When Bob and the neutron people report quasi-static, by which they usually mean static, spin order, that is spontaneous T-violation, magnetism is what T-violation really means. And what we know experimentally is that there's magnetism all over the place in this problem, deep, deep, deep into the superconducting state. Parasitic, it might be dirt-induced, I don't know, but what you do know is that it's always there.
Well, it would be good to see experimental.
It has been seen experimental.
It has been seen.
No, I'm talking about the superconducting one.
Okay.
No.
Muons.
D plus ID?
No.
D plus ID. There's
magnetism all over the place, and it's very mysterious, and it's always there, and nobody understands why. This is in high-quality samples.
Supposedly.
Okay, then have these experiments been done for the system?
treated in YPCO or YPCO?
No, YPCO actually doesn't extend as far until. Present experiments that I know, because it's Niedermeyer and company.
It goes
there.
It goes.
But they have to go into its low temperatures, so you know, right. Experiments in LSCO.
LSCO, Panagopoulos et al. It actually extends all the way to 70%.
Yeah, I understand. But the old experiments only extended up to about 12%.
I agree.
So it's a temperature scale.
Yes.
Because again, that's the theory. Why do you think that it's not important?
Well, most of the things that interest me happen at too high temperature. Much higher temperature.
Well, we don't know what we're missing here, right? Yeah. I was just arguing that actually, if you apply the field, you already have a very high temperature. That was one question.
So one
question, let's make it last one.
The organizer didn't care. I just wanted to make a comment since my name was taken in vain by the last speaker. I've been looking at these samples for 8 years now with the standard twin microscope.
Will you speak louder?
It's very sensitive. You know, I can see microgauss. And sort of my experience is the cleaner the sample is, the cleaner the sample is, the less likely you're going to see odd stuff. We measure the half vortex in a controlled geometry, and it's a half within a few percent. We've looked at the temperature dependence. From half a degree to 90 degrees, and it's half, within, our experimental accuracy. The odd stuff that I've seen always seems to be connected with some sort of disorder in the sample.
Well, it might mean also that the ground state is a bona fide D-wave, and then we are considering D+IE.
Look. It's just as weird if you get spontaneous magnetism from dirt as it is if you get a gravity edge. Okay? It's just as bizarre. And you damage the sample a little bit, you become magnetic. One second. I don't pretend to know.
We have the whole spin glass problem. It's okay.
I think the problem is the lasers. But the truth is, we don't know. The neutron experiments are, in a funny way, prejudiced towards seeing spin. And one of the things, actually, I'm concerned about is maybe they're not seeing spin. Maybe they're seeing orbital currents, and the experiment's just hard to interpret.
Let's go. It's a good place to stop. Thank you.